here on.
So, as I was discussing, obviously everybody knows that we finished 1 Samuel last week, which was the death of Saul. And if you were here on time, I'm sorry if you were here earlier, they... we just talked about the fact that
you all just got here, right?
Yeah, we just.
Don't like, your sister.
I'm just kidding. They I don't take attendance. It doesn't matter to me. But you would think in your mind, in all these years we've kind of read through the Bible and all, you just kind of picture, you know, 1 Samuel ends, Saul died, 2 Samuel, David takes over. But that is in no way the case. It's a very convoluted struggle. I tried to rationalize some, you know, metaphors that, you know, I could play with, and so I guess we'll kind of go through those as we get there, but just suffice to say, it's not going to be as easy as we like to make it, and which is kind of odd, because you think that, you know, he was anointed king, it would just be, but, you know, it's hard to, as we go through this, you got to think, A, Samuel's dead, so nobody, I shouldn't say nobody, most of the important players in this anointing are not even alive now, and so... as with all things human, as Saul became king, certain people coalesced around him and his leadership. So obviously, the best thing I can think of, and I've been listening to some stuff this weekend, is when somebody kind of blows your preset notions and your pre, and it even pertains to the Bible and all the things we think we know, when somebody blows that out of the water, it's painful. When you have to reset what you think you know, I mean, I fight with it immensely. I'm like, nah, that guy's completely wrong, heretic, you know, and then it just dwells on you, and you're like, well, maybe he's right, and this is... So, in the same way in human, as we build up an empire or a kingdom, then in, you know, humanly power, people coalesce around that. We're witnesses to that in our country. And then, when that power changes hands, it throws a lot of people's world into a complete conundrum. It exposes corruption. The people that were making money might not make money now. The people that weren't making money will make money. It's just a whole... So that's what we're going to kind of see in this overview when we first get into this, is kind of the clingers on in Saul's kingdom who have a stake in continuing that kind of thing versus the people in, you know, well, David doesn't really have a kingdom. He has like the 600 guys that have been following him around. But as we've seen in many examples, they will turn on him in an instant. But so that's just a little insight into, you know, what we're going on. So 2 Samuel... After the death of Saul, when David had returned from striking down the Amalekites, David remained 2 days in Ziklag. So, remember, the Amalekites had burned the city down, but evidently, I don't know why this is playing so long before it puts up. I have this here. Well... I knew this was going to be interesting. There you go. One behind me. After the death of Saul, when David had returned from striking down the Amalekites, David remained in Ziklag 2 days. So we know that the city was burned by the Amalekites, and David and David's wives were taken, everybody's sons. And so luckily, because they were probably slavers, you know, going to human traffic them, no one was killed. So when David, jumped up, you know, caught up with them, he was able to strike them down, you know, in the Lord's power, and return everybody's kids and everything. And they had even So the Amalekites had been raiding other places, so they were able to get some profit. And if we remember, David was smart enough to send some of that up into Israel to kind of plant some seed money for some goodwill, you know, in the future. So it says, and on the third day, behold, a man came from Saul's camp with his clothes torn and dirt on his head. And when he came to David, he fell on the ground and paid homage. David said to him, where do you come from? And he said, I have escaped from the camp of Israel. And David said to him, how did it go? Tell me. And he answered, the people fled from the battle, and also many of the people have fallen and are dead, and Saul and his son Jonathan are also dead. So it's interesting, a couple points. It's interesting, this guy is an Amalekite, so it's weird how this is intermingled. So the Amalekites weren't fighting with, as far as we know, the Philistines, but they were fighting with David in another place. But this guy, who is Amalekite, comes from the battle between the Philistines and the Israelites. So I just found that kind of odd. And then he comes with knowledge of, you know, Saul and his son Jonathan, and obviously Jonathan and David were very, very close, so this is pretty devastating news to David. I'm sorry, it just won't keep up. I'll just push ahead, and it'll eventually come up there. Then David said to the young man who told him, how do you know that Saul and his son Jonathan are dead? And the young man who told him said, by chance I happened to be on Mount Gilboa, and there was Saul leaning on his spear, and behold, the chariots and horsemen were close upon him. And when he looked behind him, he saw me and called to me, and I answered, here I am. And he said to me, who are you? And I answered him, I am an Amalekite. And he said to me, stand beside me and kill me, for anguish has seized me, and yet my life still lingers. So I stood beside him and killed him, because I was sure that he could not live after he had fallen. And I took the crown that was on his head and the armlet that was on his arm, and I have brought them here to my Lord. So, a couple things. This guy is kind of, you can kind of tell the story's a little shaky in the fact you would figure in the middle of a battle where people are killing each other and everything, you wouldn't be strolling through the park and just happen upon, you know, the king in the middle of a battle. And then, you know, for the king to turn to you and say, hey, who are you? Come over here and kill me. That's kind of an interesting, you know, there should be, you would think, obviously, because Jonathan felt that all the people there was a group of people that were tasked with keeping the king safe in battle. So those people should be very, very near the king. And for this guy to be able to kind of meander up is probably not true. If you'll remember back to last week, it doesn't match the story of the biblical record of how Saul died. So basically what this guy's doing, somehow he got a hold of the crown, and so in those days you wore a crown, and you also wore, you'll see a lot of times in the older movies, you'll see like the Egyptians driving the chariot, and they'll put a gold kind of like bracelet way up on their bicep. Well, that's kind of what this is talking about here. So he has the crown and this thing that he wrapped around his arm showing that he was the king. So you get the feeling here that he's trying to ingratiate himself with David, saying, hey, this guy's been your enemy. I took care of him and I brought you, you know, his vestiges of his kingship. I'm going to give to you. I don't know why this is on this. Then David took hold of his clothes and tore them, and so did all the men who were with him. And they mourned and wept and fasted until evening for Saul and for Jonathan his son and for the people of the Lord and for the house of Israel, because they had fallen by the sword. And so you know, they go through this time of mourning and, you know, ashes and tearing their clothes and all the things that should happen. I guess, let me, I'm sorry, let's see if I take a minute here and redo this. If it'll, it's driving me crazy, so it's got to be driving you crazy. So I don't know what that. So let's try, see if we can make a better connection.
So do we not believe that this Amalekite finished the minute?
No, because in the biblical record it shows that he killed, remember, he killed himself.
Yeah, he but threw, it says he fell on the sword, and then here it says that he was, like, it's almost like it was a fail. He fell on his sword, but he didn't die.
Well, that's because this guy is trying to ingratiate himself. He thinks David wanted the king dead. And for a couple reasons we can get into. Let me try this. I guess he was counting on that. So let's see if this works a little better. This will, sorry about all this. Right, but in the biblical account, in 1 Samuel it says, then Saul just thrust himself all the way on and he died. That nobody had, because if you remember.
Maybe he was only mostly dead.
I was thinking about.
I've had worse.
After all, the Princess Bride.
Okay, so sorry. That was a reset.
Sorry.
It's just been an instant.
Deal with the work.
All right, so it looks like it's working now. So now, so David's kind of done this, and so now he's going to, so here you can tell David's starting to, the morning's over, now I'm going to do my investigation into how this, what's going on here. So David said to the young man who told him, "Where do you come from?" And he answered, "I am the son of a sojourner, an Amalekite." So we were talking about, like, in the middle of the battle, there would be men that their job was to protect the king. His son Jonathan was right there. All these people, if you go back to the account, he just says, "Oh, I had to be walking by, and I saw the king was kind of dead, and he asked me to kill." It's like there's a lot of, you know, weird things in his testimony about how he ended up with the crown and the amulet. Amulet, right? Amulet, that's what you have for breakfast. And so I am a sojourner, son of a sojourner, Amalekite. And David said to him, "How is it that you were not afraid to put out your hand and destroy the Lord's anointed?" Because you'll remember, this guy's thinking David's going to want to be king. He doesn't realize David had all kinds of chances to kill Saul, and he basically said, "The Lord will deal with it. I'm not going to do that." Because it would have been a really, it would have set a precedent, which kind of happened anyway later on, of, you know, killing and stealing the crown and taking the throne and all the things that men tend to do. Then David called one of the young men and said to him, "Go execute him." And he struck him down so that he died. And David said to him, "Your blood be on your head, for your own mouth has testified against you, saying, I have killed the Lord's anointed." So obviously this guy's play at getting ingratiated with David went 180 degrees south, and now he's dead. And David lamented with this lamentation over Saul and Jonathan's son, and he said it should be taught to the people of Judah. "Behold, it is written in the book of Jasher." And the book of Jasher really does exist, and it's kind of out there. I didn't go through it, but I was kind of, I know many, a couple times in the Bible it's talked about. It's written in the book of Jasher, and there's, just for a little background, there's some people that believe it should be included, it should have been included in the canon, and it wasn't. So there's a couple like that, like the book of Enoch and that kind of stuff. So this is basically what's going to be called the Song of the Bow. For some reason, I don't, it must be a Hebrew translation, but there's tradition that says that this was taught to, like, all the military personnel, and this was like their war song going to war. I guess, like, the Marines have the, you know, their cadence, and the Air Force has their song, that this was basically what that was. And it says, "Your glory, O Israel, is slain on your high places. How the mighty have fallen. tell it not in Gath, publish it not in the streets of Ascalon, lest the daughters of the Philistines rejoice, lest the daughters of the uncircumcised exult. It's rather, I found it interesting. I was just looking at some news, and you go back to October 7th, and Gath and Ascalon were all rejoicing and happy about the terror that had happened in Israel and what they had done. And right now it's not a very rejoicing place, so be careful what you wish for. You mountains of Gilboa, let there be no dew or rain upon you, nor fields of offering, for the shield of the mighty was defiled, the shield of Saul not anointed with oil. So what this is speaking to, all their shields back then were made of wood, and they would put leather over top of them, which would help slow, you know, stop the spears from penetrating. And you obviously had to keep that oiled or it would dry up. And so now, since Saul's dead, his shield will no longer be oiled and, you know, it's going to dry up. From the blood of the slain, from the fat of the mighty, the bow of Jonathan turned not back, and the sword of Saul returned not empty. Saul and Jonathan, beloved and lovely in life and in death, they were not divided. They were swifter than eagles, and they were stronger than lions. So, you know, it's kind of, you look back at like I said, Jonathan's a really, really interesting character in the book. He's in the Bible. And he's, you know, it really seems like a really, really great person. And but even through all that, as much as his dad did, and even when he went to his dad and said, hey, you're doing something bad, he always did it out of respect. And even, you'll remember a couple times, Saul flew off the handle at him and talked about his mother and all kind of stuff. But in the end, they were still together. He still stuck by his father. They were still family. You daughters of Israel, weep over Saul, who clothed you luxuriously in scarlet, who put ornaments of gold on your apparel. How the mighty have fallen in the midst of battle. Jonathan lies slain on your high places. So this is again to the people. You know, Israel was kind of this like destitute people wandering through the wilderness. And finally under Saul, they kind of had a cohesive group of people. And, you know, some people made out well in that. And it says, verse 26, I am distressed for you, my brother Jonathan. Very pleasant you have been to me. Your love to me was extraordinary, surpassing the love of a woman. So, you know, we saw all throughout the book of 1 Samuel how close Jonathan and David were. And Jonathan was even willing, you know, he would have ascended to the throne on his father's death, but he was willing to step aside and say, you know, I'm going to work with you. When you become king, I'm going to be part of your group. I don't need to sit on that throne. I'm willing to just work with you, which is extraordinary, you know. So, you know, how the mighty have fallen and the weapons of war have perished. So they kind of got, you know how that is, after the battle, the winning side goes around and takes whatever they can from. So Israel, it seems like now they've kind of got on their feet, but a lot of times they were fighting with, you know, sticks and stones and all that kind of stuff because they really didn't have a lot of metallurgy. But it looks like now they've lost some of what they had. So, 2 Samuel chapter 2. After this, David inquired of the Lord, which is always a really good, that's pretty impressive, because throughout the last couple chapters of 1 Samuel, we saw sometimes that David tended to do, it looks like David just did things without consulting, just tried to rely on his own guile, and it got him into some really, really deep problems. So here he's smart enough to inquire of the Lord right off the bat. And it says, shall I go up into the cities of Judah? And the Lord said to him, go up. David said, to which shall I go up? And he said, to Hebron. So the Lord's given him permission. And if you remember, I mean, obviously we know Jerusalem's going to become the city of David eventually, but right now Hebron for a little while seems to be like the capital for, I mean, I don't know how many people know, but Annapolis was the capital of the United States for a while. You know, until somebody decided to build a swamp at D.C. and fill it with sewage.
And allocated.
And David brought up his men who were with him, everyone with his household, and they lived in the towns of Hebron. So these guys who've always been kind of on the outside, on the outs, are finally like in, back in the congregation of God's people. But it's never going to be easy. And the men of Judah came, and there they anointed David king over the house of Judah. And they told David, it was the men of Jabesh-Gilead who buried Saul. So you remember, they hung his body up on the wall of the city, and these guys went and took it down, burned it real quick, and buried it so they couldn't find it, so he wouldn't be, like, defiled hanging on the wall. So, again, David has shown some real... First off, one of the things, by killing the Amalekite, then he's kind of wiped his hands of anybody being able to say, hey, David might have had a little hand in how Saul died, and that's why he's trying to ascend to the throne. He's like, no, the guy that did it, I even killed. So I have nothing to do with it. And so David went up there with his two wives, Hanum of Jezreel and Abigail, the widow of Nabal of Carmel. And David brought up his men and everyone with his household, and they lived in the towns of Hebron. And the men of Judah came, they anointed David king over the house of Judah, and they told David, it was the men again, back to that. David sent messengers to the men of Jabesh-Gilead and said to them, may you be blessed by the Lord because you showed disloyalty to Saul, your Lord, and buried him. So David here is being really smart politically, like he's soothing over, like these are all obviously the people that are going to be kind of upset that Saul's not the king anymore because they were loyal to him. And he's trying to like put a little ointment on that sore and say, hey, I didn't have anything to do with it, and what you did was really, really good. I praise you for the bravery of going up there and doing it. Said, now may the Lord show steadfast love and faithfulness to you, and I will do good to you because you have done this thing. So again, a nice political move. Now therefore let your hands be strong and be valiant, for Saul your Lord is dead, and the house of Judah has anointed me king over them. So as right now, he's only king. It's back to almost like the judges where they were in a small little area. So far, only Judah has anointed him king, and he's basically reaching out to the other tribes and saying, hey, come on board. Saul's gone. There's no reason, you know, to linger with that. Come on board. And it's kind of interesting that this thing with the house of Judah will, you know, carry on for thousands of years being loyal to David, you know, or hundreds of years, I should say. Even when the kingdom splits, they stay loyal to David's family. But Abner, So here you have here you got the bad guy being introduced. The son of Ner, commander of Saul's army, took Ish-Bohethish, the son of Saul, and brought him over to Menahem, and he made him king over Gilead, and the Asherites, and Jezreel, Ephraim, and Benjamin, and all of Israel. So it's kind of funny, even you could tell how later some of this was edited in the fact that you're already seeing the split of they're calling one place the house of Israel, and the other place is being called Judah. So you kind of see hints of what's happening. And you see, what's interesting about this, I found, so this is Abner, son of Ner, commander of Saul's army. You think if Saul died in battle, this guy would have died too. He should have been right there, you know, fighting to the finish. But at some point he said, hey, I'm going to save my hide. And now, even though we got beat because of me playing a major role in it, I'm going to make the king's son king again so I can hold on to the role I have. Kind of I mean, I know not to talk too much politics, but it's just funny. There's a, I was just watching a thing, I don't know, there's an Admiral King during World War II that ran the U.S. Navy, and if you ever read his life story, his biography, he's an amazing, amazing guy. And they have a picture of him when he left the Navy at the end of the war, and he had like two ribbons on, like, you know, stoic guy, like. And then you look at these guys we got on TV now, you know, half of them are transgender and stuff, and they got, you know, a row, they look like some third world dictator with stuff hanging all over them, and then here, they haven't won a battle, they haven't won a war in like 70 years, you know, and here these guys fought for our very existence, and when it was done, they weren't really too prideful about it. So it's the same kind of thing here. I'm looking, this guy's got to be like, you know, trying to hold on to his position, even though he's a failure, it looks like. So obviously, you have this split. So you have, you know, one of Saul's sons, like, leading part of the country, part of a few of the tribes, and David leading Jesus. So Ish-bosheth, Saul's son, was 40 years old when he began to reign over Israel, and he reigned 2 years. But the house of Judah followed David. And at the time, David was king in Hebron over the house of Judah was 7 years and 6 months.
So if you look at it this way, you know, people may have to question why he lived. The answer that he was given them was that he was told to go make his son king. So he had the excuse and everything wrapped up in one easy swoop, and he doesn't lose nothing.
Yeah.
He looked out for himself very well.
He wasn't too dumb, was he?
No.
So Abner, the son of Ner, and the servants of Ish-bosheth, son of Saul, went out from Mahanaim to Gibeon. So I'll show you where Mahanaim is in a minute. That I meant for this map to come up at the end because we're going to get a name of a place, and I kind of brought it up here. And Joab, the son of Zerahiah, and the servants of David went out and met them at the pool of Gibeon. And they sat down, the one on the side of the pool and the other on the other side of the pool. And Abner said to Joab, "Let the young men arise and compete before us." And Joab said, "Let them arise." So I kind of remember we talked about this a little time. There was sometimes in battle, like the whole thing with Goliath, you would send your best person out, they would send their best person out. That way, if you lose, I get all your stuff, and I don't have to kill all of you, and I don't have to lose some of my people, and you'll just have to, you know, I'll be your ruler. Well, that's kind of what they're doing here, and you're going to see they pick 12. So they arose and passed over by number, 12 for Benjamin, and Ish-bosheth the son of Saul, and 12 for the servants of David. So they divide into like teams of 12, and each caught his opponent by the head and thrust the sword in his opponent's side. So they fell together. Therefore, that place was called Helkah Hazarim, which is at Gibeon. So it's interesting. So that's what that pin drop on that, you'll see that's that. You can see just off to the right, it's called Helkath Hazirim, which means, if you look it up, the name as it stands means field of the sword edges, and it's applied to the scene of conflict, and with 12 champions, each from an army of Joab and Abner pairs together, each slaying his fellow. Some following the Septuagint would read Salah HaTashim, field of the crafty, i.e. of the ambush. But in the bottom line it says, probably, however, the text as it is stands correct. So, this is where you could metaphorically say, how many churches, so what is the sword of metaphor? The word of God. So how many churches go out and battle other churches and start swinging their words because what they have, you know, their theology all down 100% correct and 100% right, and when it's all said and done years later, the churches are destroyed and nobody won at that game.
Well,
That is the best metaphor I got out of that little thing. Because I just, like I said, I remember coming up when I first got saved, there was like this laughing in the spirit thing. People were falling in the house. And I remember one church, Kirksville, where Karen's dad lived, they got big into that. And now, you know, the church, you see like 6 cars in the parking lot. There used to be like 500, you know. So it's all that. And they fought with the other churches around them. And it's just, again, the, you know, the name it, claim it, grab it, blab it. All these churches go through these, you know, kind of go through these machinations. And instead of reaching out to the world, we grab our swords and go after the other people that are in God's kingdom. And we're just battling. We're just hitting each other with our swords, and nobody wins at that. And that's what the world sees. The world looks.
How many churches are in this small community?
Oh, yeah. And I'm sure they're banging. They've been banging each other's swords for years,
yeah,
I'm sure.
In this little place.
Well, I've been in a little town where there's like a. You pull up to a 4-way stop, and there's a different church. There's a Baptist church, Methodist church, you know, and there's a different church on every corner right across the street from each other. I said, that's got to be interesting. So hopefully, you know, I know my brother-in-law was pastor for a while, and I know down where he was in Columbia, like once a month, a lot of the pastors got together and had a breakfast, and they kind of tried to break down that, you know, barrier of, you know, us fighting over, you know, it was always called sheep stealing, right? You didn't proselytize out to the world, you went to the parking lot of the other church and tried to, you know, steal sheep. It was basically what you were doing. So they were, I give them credit, they were kind of trying to prevent that. And it's probably a bad story, but just the other funny side of that was just to hear. There's always those problem people in church that, you know, somehow come in and they seem okay at first, and then they get on a little niche, whatever thing they're in, and that becomes the hammer. He told me it was kind of funny because there would be like 20 pastors, and somebody would stand up and say, who has Bob so-and-so this week? And they would be like, yeah, he was at my church. And they all knew, they watched these people go through each congregation, you know, looking for the perfect church, which, as they say, if you find the perfect church, don't go in, you'll ruin it. So I just found it's just an interesting thing here that they just all killed each other. Nobody won. And the battle
would be like, thanks for volunteering me to be one of
you. Yeah, thanks for picking me. And the battle was very fierce that day, and Abner and the men of Israel were beaten before the servants of David. And the 3 sons of Jeshua were Joab, Abishai, and Asahel. Now Asahel was as swift of foot as a wild gazelle, and Asahel pursued Abner as he went, and turned neither to the right hand or to the left hand, following Abner. So after, obviously, when this battle broke into a full battle, this guy Abner, which seems to be his modus operandi, is up and running. He's out of here. Well, this guy, who evidently is very, very fast, is hot on his trail, and he's not turning to the right or left. He's like completely focused on getting this guy. Then Abner looked behind him and said, is it you, Asahel? And he answered, it is I. And Abner said to him, turn aside to your right hand or your left hand and seize one of the young men and take his spoil. But Asahel would not turn aside from following him. So it's kind of interesting here. You see that Abner's fleeing with a couple people, and it's basically the old adage, I don't have to outrun the bear, I just have to outrun you. So he's basically yelling back to the guy, hey, get one of the guys behind me and take all his stuff. Leave me alone. So this guy is obviously, he's an interesting character for leading the army. And Abner said again turn aside lest I see one of the young men take his spoil. But Asahel would not turn aside from following him. And Abner said again to Asahel, turn aside from following me. Why should I strike you to the ground? How then could I lift up my face to your brother Joab? So if you'll remember, this is still one of those things where if he kills his brother, then he has he's the Avenger of Blood. He has the obligation to go after him and kill him. So evidently he knows his brothers are pretty bad, and if you know anything, Joab's going to end up being David's commander of his army. So evidently he's a pretty bad dude. So he's like, look, I don't want to have to face your brother. Just stop this. But he refused to turn aside. Therefore, Abner struck him in the stomach with the butt of his spear. So the spear came out at his back. That had to be kind of a horrible way to die. And he fell there and died where he was. And all who came to the place where Asa had fallen and died stood still. So it's a group of people following. He's the fastest, so he's kind of out in front. When other people get there, they find his body. But Joab and Abishai, again, now they're the Avengers of Blood, pursued Abner, and as the sun was going down, they came to the hill of Amaha, which lies before Giah, on the way to the wilderness of Gibeah. And the people of Benjamin gathered themselves together behind Abner, and became one group, and took their stand on the top of the hill. So, throughout their history, the tribe of Benjamin always seems to be on the wrong side of what we see, because we have the big picture of going on. You know, they're kind of just rallying behind their guys that, if you remember, Abner is the army chief of their tribes that they've anointed Saul's son over, so they're kind of rallying to his defense, but Benjamin always seems to be on the wrong side of all these situations. They get themselves, and it's kind of interesting that there's another Saul in the tribe of Benjamin that's going to be very, very important to us. So it's kind of interesting that God took these people that always seemed to be wrong, and out of that group of people, he picked the guy that wrote most of the New Testament, at least the epistles in the New Testament. So I just found that.
They do all this then, but if when the split happens later, they're the only ones that stay with you.
Yeah. So you would think maybe they learned their lesson at some point in this.
Could be here.
Yeah. And Abner called to Joab, "Shall the sword devour you, devour forever? Do you not know that the end will be bitter? How long will it be before you tell your people to turn in pursuit of their brothers?" So it's an interesting take that, you know, yeah, remember when they kill him, then there's going to be a group of people that are going to want to kill them. And this is basically a back and forth until somebody says, enough. And Joab says, as God lives, if you had not spoken, surely the men would not have given up the pursuit of their brothers until the morning. So Joab blew the trumpet, and all the men stopped and pursued Israel no more, nor did they fight anymore. So basically, somebody called time out, kind of came to a rational thought and said, there's no more reason for people to die today. Let's stop this, killing each other. Basically, their brothers. So,
what the best fights are between brothers.
Yeah, there you go.
Why are you looking at that? Look at me like, I'll tell you the truth.
So here is, just to show you how wild this had to be, where this pin dropped is that Hekrath Hazarim, where the fight was, where the 12 guys from each side died. This, if you can look at the, can you see the, oh God. If you look all the way up there, it's moving, finally. This top left. This is where they are now. So that's how far these guys have chased each other. Can everybody see it up there where the pointer is? So that's how far they have kind of, you know, they've crossed the Jordan. They've, you know, been through all kinds of stuff. So this didn't just, you know, in our mind you can quickly see the, oh, they're just chasing down the street. This is going on. This went on. This is running across a long, long way. That's probably why they were like, yeah, if he calls a timeout, we're good. We'll go home. Yeah. No, we're not ready to quit. And Abner and his men went all that night through Arabah, They crossed the Jordan and marched the whole morning, and they came to Menahem. So there's Abner goes up to this place, Menahem, and Joab returned from his pursuit of Abner. And when he gathered all the people together, there were missing from David's servants 19 men beside Achill. So basically 20 people died, but the servants of David had struck down of Benjamin 360. So it was a pretty, you know, lopsided victory. And they took up Achill and buried him in the tomb of his father, which was at Bethlehem. And Joab and his men marched all night, and the day broke upon them in Hebron. So when the sun came up in the morning, they were home. That was the basic premise there. So I looked up this place in Menahem, and it says, this is what I found in the background, the city must have been one of great strength. It lay east of the Jordan, as first mentioned in the history of Jacob. Here he halted after parting from Laban before the passage of the Jabbok, and the angels of God met him. Possibly it was the site of an ancient sanctuary. It is next noticed in the defining boundaries of tribal territory east of the Jordan. It lay on the border of Gad and Manasseh. And it belonged to the lot of Gad and was assigned along with Ramoth in Gilead to the Meravite Levites. So what's interesting, anybody know what that means? If it was assigned to the Levites?
It was a priestly city.
Which is?
City of Sanctuary.
City of Refuge.
City of Refuge. I'm sorry.
Right. Yeah, same thing. It's good enough. So
California?
It makes sense now why they were fleeing there and why they, if they would have got there, they couldn't. The Avenger of Blood thing, if you'll remember, wouldn't have helped.
Yeah.
As long as Joab stayed in that city, he couldn't have killed him.
But who was the high priest then?
I don't know. I'm assuming
there was. Didn't he kill it? Didn't,
well, there was a high priest in each city. Like,
so is that the one that had to die?
Yeah, there.
I thought there was one high priest.
Well, there was one.
Because the high priest had to rule, and then that person had to stay in that city until the high priest died.
Okay. Yeah. All right. So I don't know.
Yeah, they have to kill him.
Right. If he could be considered innocent, but if he left the city still while the high priest.
Well, it's interesting because the family that they want to put on the throne is the people that killed the high priest.
Yes.
So I would think, unless you live in Georgia, the judge would make ruling against you.
I just like what that name means. It's God's camp.
So where would we be at?
That's when Jacob met. And it's kind of neat because where that happened, too, is where God stopped Laban. And then where Jacob met the angels and saw him, and God warned Laban in the dream, don't do anything to Jacob.
Oh, was it the same place?
Yeah. This man.
That's what he's talking about there, when it's mentioned between
Menahem.
This is God's camp.
The former of these passages afford no justification to that as mentioned, the city of refuge. The strength of the place doubtless subtracted Abner, who fixed here the capital of Ejabeth's kingdom. To the same fortress, David fled, endangered by the rebellion of Absalom, and the forest hard by that the prince met his fate. It was made the center of one of Solomon's administrative districts, and here Abinadad, son of Edo, was stationed. I think that might. Yep, that was. That's the end of Saul 2, chapter 2. So we continue. And we're pretty much right on time. So. Questions answered? Observations?
Isn't there a lie on David's